This is Adam Kahanowitz with Vegan.fm. Here is part three of my interview with Professor Gary Francione. In this segment, Francione discusses the idea of human superiority, as he has written in his book, Introduction to Animal Rights, Your Child or the Dog. To listen to all four interviews with Professor Francione, you can find them in the audio section of abolitionistapproach.com. And thanks to Randy Sandberg for his diligence in making this and so much more material of Francione's available to the public via this website. Gary Francione on animal inferiority.
I want to make something clear to all of you and to you and to all, everybody else who's listening and reading it. Okay. And that is, you know, I know Ingrid Newkirk. I know Wayne Pacell. Some of the younger people I don't know as well. I've met some of them. I've met, you know, Shapiro once or twice. So I don't know him. I've talked with him on the phone. But, you know, some of the older people, you know, I've known for decades, you know. And this is not a matter of judging them or thinking that they're horrible people or, you know, whatever. I'm not, you know, I'm not into that. And I don't, I just, you know, and I've known Peter Singer. I've known Peter Singer for a long time. And I disagree with these people. I just disagree. I just think they're wrong. And it doesn't mean that I think that they're walking around rubbing their hands saying, boy, isn't it fun to be evil and to be screwing animals? And, right. isn't it just wonderful to be, you know, to be engaging in this subterfuge? I'm not saying that at all. I think they sincerely believe, you know, that what they're saying. I just think they're wrong. And I think what we need to do is look at what they're saying and analyze it with our brains, you know, with these big brains that we have that we think make us superior to everything on the planet, which I don't think is the case at all. But, you know, we think we have these big brains, which we do. They are creative. We are capable of doing all sorts of good things, which we don't do, unfortunately. We spend most of our brain power figuring out ways to kill other people, and which is unfortunate. But, you know, if we spend some of our brain power looking at the arguments, I think we can make an assessment that some of these arguments simply don't work. Let me give you an example of how intoxicating the idea of human superiority is. You know, you have – did I mention Tom Reagan before?
You haven't yet, okay. No.
Tom Reagan, who I also know, I have known for many years. Tom Reagan wrote Case for Animal Rights. Now, you know, Tom Reagan takes a very, very different view from Peter Singer in that he does – you know, he does defend the concept of animal rights. But let me give you – let me show you exactly how intoxicating this notion of human superiority is. It infects even Tom's work. Tom has an example in his book where he talks about – you know, you're on a lifeboat with, you know, a human and a dog, and one of them's got to go, which one goes? And he says, in that situation, you've got to throw the dog overboard. If it's a normal human and a normal dog, the normal human always wins because death is a greater harm for humans because it forecloses more opportunities for satisfaction. Now, I think that that's dead wrong, and actually I have a chapter in the book that I published last year, Animals as Persons, Essays on the Abolition of Animal Exploitation. I have an essay in which I talk about Reagan and the dog in the lifeboat and why I think that that example sort of undermines his theory in lots of ways. But it just goes to show you, Tom is, you know, Tom subscribes to a rights theory, yet Tom thinks that that death is a greater harm for humans than it is for non-humans because we, you and I, have more opportunities for satisfaction than, you know, dogs or cats or chickens or pigs or whatever. And the answer is, who says? I mean, you know, I have four dogs. They're rescue dogs. You know, I love them. I watch them play all the time. They seem to have a ball. As a matter of fact, my dogs can get satisfaction out of anything. Now I try to be a positive person. I try to be a happy person. I try to recognize that however frustrating life is for me, it's worse for a lot of other people, and it's certainly worse for a lot of non-human people. Life is rough for many humans and almost all non-humans, and so I try to keep that. But the bottom line is, you know, my border collie probably has more fun in life and has lots of opportunities for satisfaction, given that she gets satisfaction out of sniffing the air. I don't. She gets satisfaction about, you know, and all sorts of things that don't mean anything to me. So the idea that, you know, that you throw the dog out of the lifeboat because the human has greater opportunities for satisfaction just goes to show you how prejudice of that sort infects even the writings of somebody who's a rights advocate. This is very much related to Singer's notion that animals don't have an interest in their lives. Tom doesn't go that far. Tom thinks that the dog has an interest in his life. He just thinks that the dog has a qualitatively lesser interest in life than the human does. Whereas Peter says that, you know, most animals, with the exception of the non-human great apes, don't really have a sense of what it is to have a life. And so therefore, you know, they don't have that sort of they don't have those sorts of minds. So therefore, you know, they live in a sort of eternal present, and you know, whether we use them. As a matter of fact, I mean, Singer says this quite explicitly, that he says it's morally defensible to be a conscientious omnivore, or I think that's the expression he uses, conscientious omnivore.
Yeah, conscientious omnivore.
Yeah, he describes that as a morally defensible position. So understand, he's not saying, well, you know, if you're gonna eat animal products, it's wrong to do. You shouldn't do it. But if you're gonna do it, you should eat the product with the least amount of harm. He's not saying that. He's saying, if you want to eat products that involve harm, as long as you try to be conscientious, that's okay. So, and he actually says in a couple of places, as I quote in the book last year and the book that's coming out this coming year, I talk about, you know, and I quote Singer as saying, you know, there are situations in which, as a matter of fact, let me see if I can find the quote. It's actually worth reading to your people. Oh, here it is. Okay. He says this. He says,
this is out of Animal Liberation?
No, this is out of a magazine called The Vegan, which is the magazine of the Vegan Society in the United Kingdom.
Okay.
This is the autumn 2006 issue, page 19. Peter says, undoubtedly, to avoid inflicting suffering on animals, not to mention the environmental costs of intensive animal production, we need to cut down drastically on the animal products we consume. But does that mean a vegan world? That's one solution, but not necessarily the only one. If it is the infliction of suffering that we're concerned about rather than killing, then I can imagine a world in which people mostly eat plant foods, but occasionally treat themselves to the luxury of free-range eggs or possibly even meat from animals who live good lives under conditions natural for their species and then are humanely killed on the farm. Now, that's a quote from the father of the animal rights movement. Let me tell you, if I were an animal, I wouldn't want this guy as my father. I might bring an action in court to sort of be declared an orphan under those circumstances. And so, you know, and he's very explicit in animal liberation. Do I have that readily available? Hold on here. Let me see. This is page 228. He says, the real difficulty arises when we consider beings not capable of having desires for the future, beings who can be thought of as living moment by moment rather than having a continuous mental existence. Granted, even here, killing still seems repugnant. An animal may struggle against a threat to its life, even if it cannot grasp that it has a life in the sense that requires an understanding of what it is to exist over a period of time. But in the absence of some form of mental continuity, it is not easy to explain why the loss to the animal killed is not, from an impartial point of view, made good by the creation of a new animal who will lead an equally pleasant life. And then he goes on to say he's got doubts about this issue. You know, but the bottom line is he thinks that animals live in an eternal present. And so therefore, you know, killing them per se is not the problem. The problem is how you kill them and whether you make them suffer before you kill them. Tom's position is a little bit different. It's not exactly the same as Peter's. Tom's position is, well, you know, when you have to choose between a human and an animal, you should choose the human because the human has greater opportunities for preference satisfaction. Now, you know, again, I think both of those positions are highly speciesist because I think they both make assumptions. You know, they both assume that differences translate to, you know, to say that X and Y are different. You know, X and Y have different sorts of minds. Therefore, X is superior to Y. Now, it may be the case, you know, that we treat. I mean, you know, we for example, we pay more money to somebody who's a skilled brain surgeon than we do to somebody who is an uneducated manual laborer. So we obviously value these people differently. But for purposes of whether or not, of whether we're going to use either the brain surgeon or the unskilled or the uneducated manual labor as a non-consenting subject in a biomedical experiment or as a forced organ donor, I would say they're both equal. I would say that you can't say, well, it's okay to use the skilled or the unskilled layer, the uneducated laborer, rather than the brain surgeon. You know, that you can value the life of one more than you can value the life of the other. I think that becomes very elitist and wrong. And the irony is that, you know, I always get accused of taking an elitist position because I don't think we should eat animals. But yet the animal welfare position is just obscenely elitist because it rests on all sorts of notions about it rests on all sorts of speciesist notions and all sorts of notions about elitism that are sort of lurking around. I mean, the whole welfare idea, the whole notion that this is a matter of our giving, our extending, you know, our showing mercy to the lesser animals is a very, very elitist notion. But that's very much what animal welfare is.
Yeah, that's good. You know, there's two things I want to say here. One of them was just a while ago you were talking about the PETA KFC cruelty, yeah, Canada thing. And I want to make it apparent to my listeners that when Gary was talking about PETA's response of victory to that, causing people to believe that they should now continue or start for the first time to support KFC. If anyone out there is saying, you know, oh, Gary, you're putting words in people's mouths, you can go to the PETA website. In fact, I did as soon as this news broke. A PETA official had posted a forum topic about this, and they said, okay, KFC Canada is now doing the CAC killing, the CAK killing. And you'll see the rest of the responses from PETA members are all things like, yay, these are people who were once, you know, saying, oh, KFC, they're the enemy, and they, you know, we'll never support them. They're now saying, okay, I'm going to run down. This is something I actually saw. I'm going to run down the KFC. I got one down the street. I'm going to run down there right now, and I'm going to go try this vegetarian sandwich.
Yep.
And, it's plain to see there. This is actually just sending the message that, okay, now go back to KFC. Now support it. We, as an animal rights, they call themselves an animal rights organization, endorse KFC. I mean, they may not say those exact words, but I just want to make that apparent to the listeners. You also mentioned about the man and dog in the boat idea that's in Tom Reagan's work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Gary, I'm just an undergrad student. I don't have a formal education in philosophy so much, but I got to tell you, this like burning house and sinking boat idea, It really bothers me because it doesn't seem to me, and I want your impression on this, it doesn't seem to me like it even tells us anything. And I'll give you an example. Instead of saying like a man and a dog, if I were to say if I had a son and I had a grandfather who has Alzheimer's disease, there's no – I don't love one person more than the other. They're both family members,
right,
you know.
Right.
I don't put like a higher worth towards one or the other.
Right.
And if there were a fire and I saved my son before I saved my grandfather, I mean, I don't think that means that my grandfather is superior to my son. So, and I just mentioned that just to show that the whole burning house thing, I don't think it, what do you think about that? Does it really like tell us?
Well, you know, in 2000, I wrote a book called your Introduction to Animal Rights, Your Child or the Dog. And the front cover of the book was a burning house with a kid in one window and a dog in the other, and that was the issue I raised. I mean, what I basically said was, look, it's, you know, lots of times I get questions asked of me like that. People will say, if you're walking by the burning house and you can only save one, the human and the dog, who do you save? And the answer is, it depends. You know, who can I get? You know, I can only save one. Who am I going to get to first is probably the one I'm going to say. But these are stupid hypotheticals because they don't really tell us anything about the moral problems that we really face. They're artificial. They're artificial hypotheticals. Having said that, I'm happy to entertain them. And I think when you tease them out, again, using simple, non-complicated, you know, because I'll get – that's a very common question I will get when I'm talking to a group of people who aren't really – you know, when I'm talking to a group of the general public. They're not interested, you know. They're interested in animal ethics issues because they're at my lecture, but they're not, you know, they're not in, you know, they don't know that this, you know, this one's theory and that one's theory, and they don't understand, you know, and so, or they may know very little about it. And so I'll get a question. Somebody will say to me, all right, look, let me ask you a practical question. You're walking past the house and, you know, who do you save, the child or the dog or the human or the dog? I said, let me ask you a question. I'm walking by the house and I see a very old person, extremely old, 95 years old. And I know that this person is suffering from a terminal illness and he's going to be dead in 2 weeks. And I see a very young kid in the other window. I don't know the kid, but the kid, I can see the kid is a young kid, you know, teenage kid, young adult, whatever. If I make the decision to save, you know, the life of the young kid because I know the other person is very old and is going to die, and I would like to save both of them, but I can't. I'm in a situation where no matter what I do, I'm morally compromised and I won't be able to do the thing that I want to do. And I save the kid. Does that mean it's all right to use old people in biomedical experiments or put them in circuses, zoos, or rodeos, or eat them? And the answer is, of course not. It's not all right, you know. Of course, it's not all right. And so you know. Similarly, you know. I mean, if even if I decide to you know to save the you know I mean I would look at that situation because people said, well, if you save the human, it would have to be because you thought the human was superior. And I said, no, it could be that although I know that death is a harm to both the dog and the human, and I don't think death is, I disagree with Tom Reagan, and I don't think that death is any less of a harm to a non-human than it is to a human. I don't really know what death means to a non-human. Where I do know what it means, you know, I have some sense of what it means to a human, and I might say, well, look, you know, given that, you know, the human probably has all sorts of relationships and other people may be financially dependent on this human and whatever, blah, 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 I may make the decision that I'm going to save the human rather than the animal. But that's not because I think that the animal is inferior. It's because I my own limitations in terms of understanding all the facts I need to understand to make the decision. You know, it's my own limitations that may lead me in that situation. But the bottom line is, whatever choice I make doesn't mean that it's all right for me to use the other as some sort of instrument, in some sort of instrumental way, any more than it would mean that if I save the young person rather than the old person, I could use old people instrumentally. I mean, we're confronted in situations in which there are conflicts. You know, I mean, you know. Your kid's at the hospital, and you know some other person's kid's at the hospital, you know, I'm always asked, you know, would you sacrifice a dog to save your child? And the answer is, you know, I'd sacrifice your kid to save my kid. You know, that's just the way people are. You know, I mean, you know, if your kid and my kid are at the hospital, and there's one, you know, they both need a pint of blood, and there's one pint of blood left, I'm gonna end up saying, I want my kid. You know, I'm going to do whatever I can to get my kid to get the pint of blood. You know, I mean, I remember once many years ago, one of the first animal rights things I ever did was, this must have been 1983. And I was doing a debate. Was it 83? 84 maybe. And it was a long time ago. And I'm doing.
Wasn't even born.
You weren't even born yet. So go ahead, make, you know, go ahead, plunge me into my midlife crisis. And go ahead, do that, do that. You know what?
I'm working on it.
Hey, look, the difference. Let me tell you something. You can plunge me into a midlife crisis, but the fact still remains. You live in Omaha.
Okay, I saw that coming.
I'm only kidding. All right.
Yeah, because New Jersey's better. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's. I was asked by the guy moderating the debate was a man named Roger Karras. He's now dead, and he used to be the ABC wildlife correspondent, and then he went on to be the president of the ASPCA in Manhattan, New York City, and so he was moderating this debate between me and some vivisectors. As I recall, they were vivisectors, and he said to me. He said, let me ask you a question. He said, if there were a rat with bubonic plague that was trying to get into your house, would you kill the rat? And I said, well, actually, yes, I'd kill the rat, but if you had bubonic plague and you were trying to get into my house, I'd probably kill you. So it's not really an interesting question as to whether I'd killed the rat. Yeah. And everybody started laughing, and he got very upset because he thought that I was making fun of him, and I wasn't, because it was the first time anyone ever asked me that question. And I wasn't meaning to sort of, cause him to become an object of derision in any way. I was simply saying, look, you know, these are dumb questions. I mean, you know, somebody says, if a lion were about to attack you, would you kill the lion? And the answer is, well, you know, probably. I mean, you know,
They belong to a long list of just trying to the gotcha questions, like, aha, you know, there's a hole in your theory.
Sure, yeah, sure. I mean, and so you know, and there may be situations in which, look, I certainly think you can defend, if you walk by the burning house, you could defend in all sorts of ways the decision to save the dog rather than the human. I mean, let me tell you something. If I'm walking by the burning house and the human is Adolf Hitler, and the dog is a dog that I don't particularly like, I'm going to save the dog. So I think that there are all sorts of situations in which you know, and again, I don't want to, you know, I mean, we're sort of having a little repartee here. And I don't want to encourage anybody to think that I endorse any sort of violence. I am very much a follower of the principle of ahimsa, as the Jains understand that concept. It's very, very important to me. I do not believe in violence of any sort, which is, you know, again, one of the reasons why it's great disappointment to me that there are so many people in the animal rights movement who are just so angry and want to hurt this one and hurt that one, and let's go after our enemies and let's demonize the world, and not recognizing that it's we who need to examine ourselves and not others that we need to demonize. And I am very, very, very much opposed, and I think it's very harmful when you have people who claim to be animal rights advocates who go on national television saying, yes, it's okay to kill people or what. I mean, that just makes my skin crawl, and it makes me very, very, very disappointed. And I think that, you know, it's got to be a movement of nonviolence. So I don't know, as somebody who's really committed to nonviolence, whether if the lion were about to attack me, would I really kill the lion, or would my radical principles of nonviolence kick in? But the bottom line is, whether they would or wouldn't, for most people think self-defense, reasonable self-defense, is perfectly legitimate. And I understand that, and I understand the argument that self-defense is justifiable. And so therefore, I would say, you know, yeah, go ahead and kill the lion. But what is that, you know, what does that tell you about whether it's all right to keep lions in zoos? And the answer is, it doesn't tell you bupkis. It tells you nothing. And you know, and I, so I think we have to, but you're right. There's a whole line of these, you know, I got you questions, and they tell us nothing. You know, let me tell you something. The one thing I've learned in teaching moral philosophy over many years is lifeboats and burning houses are crummy places to form moral principles. And because those are not, you know, one of the arguments I make in Introduction to Animal Rights is we bring these animals into existence. We create these. We bring these domesticated animals into existence to use as things for us. And then we sit around and we wring our hands saying, you know, what are our moral obligations? Well, the answer's already been, you know, been answered by the fact that we bring them into existence as domesticates that we exploit. We bring them into existence for this. What I want to do is stop us from dragging them into the burning house and then saying, how are we going to resolve the conflict? I mean, you drag a thing, you drag a piece of property, you know, into the burning house and then say, who are we going to save, the human or the piece of the chattel that we've just dragged into the burning house? The answer is, you're going to say, you know, I mean, that's an easy question. Just as it would have been an easy question if you had asked a white person in 1840, you're walking by a burning house, you asked a person in Virginia or in Kentucky or someplace where they had slavery, in 1840, you're walking by a burning house, and you see a white person and a black person in a house, who are you going to save? They would think you were nuts to ask the question, because all people, you know, all people of color at that time in those places, with very few exceptions, but for the most part, were chattel slaves. And so therefore, the idea of that there'd be a choice between who you're going to save, a member of the moral and legal community, and something which is outside the moral and legal community by virtue of being a thing, who are you going to save? That's a stupid question, isn't it? And so, you know, and it's a stupid question when you say, you know, should you save the human or the dog or the human and the cow? The cow only exists because we eat them, or because we use their milk, or products made from them, or we make shoes out of them and stuff. I mean, the cow only exists as some sort of instrumental thing. So when you say, who are you going to save, the human or the cow? The answer is that that's like asking the person in 1840, who are you going to save? The member of the moral and legal community, the white person who is a full human person like you, or the slave, which is a chattel, which is a piece of chattel property. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, you know, I want to change gears a little bit here.
Yeah.
We've been talking a lot about just the theory of the animal rights movement itself. I'd like to go to the theory of the action. So I think there's a lot of listeners out there who are just very confused, as I was when I first became a vegetarian, which is something I want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, I subscribe to this. I've seen these injustices. I'm changing my views. I don't know what to do. I mean, I know where to get bumper stickers, and I know, you know, I don't know where to, you know, talk with other vegans and forums. What am I going to do to be active? And one of the things people start with is vegetarianism. Do you think vegetarianism, or to be exact, lacto-ovo-vegetarianism, which is a diet consisting of no animal products except those that don't require the animal to be killed directly?
Well,
all
animal products require animals to be killed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
direct. I don't know.
Direct is not a funny word, but yeah, go ahead.
Well, I think we know what the vegetarian term at least connotates. Do you think that vegetarianism is a good first step?
Well, I mean, look, it's not what I would promote, and I'll tell you why. Because I think it encourages, you know, there's a movement in Europe, or parts of Europe, you know, to sort of get people to draw this distinction between flesh and other products and sort of have an anti-flesh movement, but, you know, not include dairy and stuff like that. And I really, doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Maybe something's being lost in the translation from French or German, but it doesn't make sense to me. Because I can't distinguish between meat and dairy. I mean, as I said before, dairy animals are kept alive longer. They're treated worse. They all end up in the same slaughterhouse in the end, after which their flesh is consumed. So, you know, if somebody becomes, you know, which is very common when people stop eating meat, is they start eating more cheese and dairy products, other dairy products. And, you know, given that I think that there is more suffering in a glass of milk than there is in a pound of steak, I mean, I wouldn't eat either of them. But if I were sitting in a situation where, you know, you had a gun to my head and there was a steak in front of me and a glass of milk, and you said, I'm going to blow your brains out unless you eat one of these things, they both repulse me. I think they're both immoral, obviously, but they both repulse me aesthetically. I probably would end up drinking the milk simply because it would probably gross me out less than eating flesh, and it would probably cause me less, you know, any animal products in my system now probably, being a vegan for 30 years would probably, or almost 30 years would probably make me vilely sick, but.
If you were to eat animal products.
Well, yeah, yeah. And the couple times that people have slipped stuff to me, you know, where I didn't know, you know, I'm very sensitive to it now. I get vilely sick. As a matter of fact, I remember once being in Spain and going into a restaurant and being assured by the people that the artichoke hearts were fried in just olive oil and there was no pork, because there's a tendency to put pork in a lot of things in Spain. And I was assured that wasn't the case. And I ate the artichoke hearts, as did my partner, Anna. As a matter of fact, I believe Tom Reagan was with us on that trip. Tom and Nancy Reagan were with us on that trip. As a matter of fact, I'm sure that they were. And the four of us ate the artichoke hearts, and we all became vilely ill. And I went back to the restaurant and spoke with another person, another person in the restaurant who told me that, in fact, there was pork in there, but they took it out and they thought that that was fine, that as long as that it had been cooked with pork. It's a real serious problem. For a while, I was taking some vitamin, and I was becoming ill, and I couldn't figure out. It never occurred to me that it was the vitamin. And then I found out that the vitamin contained a form of vitamin D that, mm-hmm. this was some years ago, that, that, you know, is derived from animal products. And, I'm really, really very, very sensitive. So I would probably in that horrible situation of having to eat the meat or the drink, the milk, I would probably drink the milk because both would cause me to get sick. The milk may be less. I don't even know. But if I were making the decision simply on suffering grounds, I'd probably eat the steak, because I think there's probably more suffering in that glass of milk or that dish of ice cream or that cheese pizza than there is in the steak. And so to the extent that people are choosing, you know, that they want to become vegetarian, they become vegetarian because they think that they're doing something morally good. Again, I don't want to sort of rain on their parades or anything, but I want them to think about it. I mean, when people ask me that questions, you know, like I have students ask me all the time, you know, I'm listening to you, I'm really impressed by what you're saying, and it's really got me thinking. I think I'm going to become a vegetarian. And I always say, why? Why don't you become a vegan? And I say, well, you know, that's too radical. And I say, that's not radical at all. Come on, it's easy. And how can I do it? And I said, well, you can do it right now. You know, you can do it, like, you can make the decision today. It's really easy. It's only the animal rights people who say it's difficult. Which is ironic. It's really ironic that it's the animal rights people who are always saying it's the extreme thing.
It bugs me.
Oh, man. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And what I tell them, I say, look, if you can't do it right away, I tell them to do it in three steps. You know, eat vegan for breakfast for a month, because it's really easy. I mean, you know, you don't even have to try hard to eat vegan for breakfast. You can have a nutritious breakfast without a really good breakfast without any animal products. Do that for a month, and then go to lunch, and then do dinner, and then you see your arms and legs don't fall off, you don't go blind, you know, everything's fine, you know, you can still walk, I tell them to go vegan in steps, just like if somebody comes up to me and says, should I eat cage, I'm really interested in transitioning to veganism, should I start with cage-free eggs, I say, no, start with veganism. If you can't do the vegan thing right away, then at least, you know, do it in stages. And you can do this. This is not a hard thing. You can do this. And I'm telling you, Adam, you know, it's only the animal people who portray it as the animal people are always there. They're the people who argue with me about whether or not veganism is extreme. I even, you know, frankly, I don't even like the word vegan. I mean, I say vegetarian. I mean, vegan has the additional connotation of – means you don't use animal products, because vegetarianism, you know, pertains more to what we eat.
Right.
But I mean, in my judgment, vegetarian means vegetarian. You only eat vegetables. You know, you only eat nuts, fruits, you know, green vegetables or whatever color vegetables you want.
Yeah, that's the original meaning.
And I use vegan because I also don't wear wool, I don't wear leather, I don't wear silk. And I don't use any products. You know, people have to also realize this. Those people who use animal product, who use like body creams and shampoos and stuff like that that contain animal products, that stuff does get into your system. As a matter of fact, your skin is one of the best exchange mechanisms for getting stuff into your body, which is why a lot of medicines are administered by rubbing them on your body. I mean, why do you think that form of administration is used? Because your skin is an extremely efficient transporter of substances from the outside of your body to the inside of your body. So if you are using, Anna, if you're a vegan and you're using, if you intend to be a vegan and you are using shampoos that contain lanolin, for example, that stuff is getting into your body. And if you're using creams that have D3 3 or that has a lot of them do, unfortunately, or that have other sorts of, you know, stearates, magnesium stearates in lots of cases.
Yeah.
Some magnesium stearate comes from plant source, but some magnesium stearate comes from cows and or other animals. And so, you know, that stuff's getting into your system. So, you know, but yeah, I mean, again, you know, I like to be positive with people because I think it's really important to be positive, because remember something, we're talking to different groups of people. You got the people who are saying, you know, they're people like me who are, you know, I mean, you aren't going to convince me. You can spend all day, all night, and tomorrow and through the weekend trying to convince me not to be a vegan. It ain't going to happen. No one's come up with an argument yet. No one has come anywhere near having an argument yet that will persuade me that it is acceptable for us to exploit non-human animals under any circumstance. And then there are people on the other side. It is unlikely that the books I've written to date or the one that I've just finished, it's unlikely that those books are going, you know, that some people at HSUS or PETA are going to read the new book that I've got coming out about the animal rights debate, Abolition or Regulation, and they're going to read it and they're going to say, oh, my God, you know, he's right. That's not going to happen, unfortunately. But there's also a zillion other people out there. I'm not writing, and in many ways, I'm not writing the book. I wish my friends at HSUS and PETA would read my stuff and consider it and debate it and discuss it. And if I'm wrong, show me where I'm wrong. I mean, I really would like that a lot. I'm confident they can't. But I would welcome, and if they think they're right, I don't understand why they are so reluctant to debate. I just don't understand it. I really don't understand why they won't engage the ideas, because I think it's important to engage the ideas. But there's a zillion people out there who are concerned about this issue. Some of them are involved in groups, but they don't know exactly how they feel about the issues. And then there's a lot of people who aren't involved in groups at all who are concerned about the issue of animal ethics. And those are the people really I'm talking to. And I'm finding, I mean, I'm just one guy. I don't have a big organization in back of me. I mean, my website, which I think is, www.abolitionistapproach.com. I think we have a really decent website. And let me tell you, it's all done by volunteer, you know, it's done largely by volunteer help. I've had to pay for some of the things that we do and some of the transcriptions, you know, when people transcribe things and stuff, I often have to pay for that. But our website was basically, you know, designed, you know, by volunteer, and so I'm very, very grateful for that help. But you know, with a small number of people, and a relatively small amount of money, you know, we're making a lot of headway into this issue, and so I think that, you know, we need to educate people, and I try very hard, and I encourage everybody to, you know, when somebody new comes around and asks, you know, nobody, you should never make anybody feel like they're asking a dumb question. If I had a nickel for every time somebody asked me, what do you do when you're walking by the house and you see the burning house, and, you know, and if I had a nickel for every time, you know, somebody ask me that question, I could retire and, you know, go live in Crete or someplace nice and warm and sunny.
Or Omaha.
Yes, I could buy a house in Omaha and exactly. And yes, something I've been thinking about a lot lately. And so I could do that. But you know, we should never, ever, ever make people feel they're asking dumb questions. We should never get angry with people who ask questions that, you know, like I do get questions from time to time that are intended. They're intended to try to make fun of what I'm, you know, my position. For example, I will oftentimes, you know, someone will say, well, yeah, but what about plants? Now, unless the person has a particular, when people ask that, 99% of the time, no, I take that back, 99.9999999% of the time, that's not asked as a serious question. That's asked as a question to try to sort of get you going and wind you up.
And, or like the meat, like animals are made of meat. Why are they made of meat?
Exactly.
Sort of, or, you've had that one.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and what I tend to do is to sort of say, you know, to treat that, you know, I try like with the plant question to treat it seriously, and I say, you know, look, even the Jains in Jainism, in the religion of Jainism, they believe the plants are sentient, but they believe that plants have only one sense touch. They don't have minds the way insects or birds or mammals or fish or whatever have. And so although Jains are permitted to eat plants, they're supposed to eat as few as possible because, you know, plants have life force in them. Now, but again, even the Jains who have spiritual views about plants draw a line between plants and everything else because everybody realizes, including people who give spiritual or moral value or whatever you want to call it to plants, even they recognize that there is a distinction to be made here between plants and everything else. And the reason is we all know that, you know, if you cut a head of, you know, if I cut a head of lettuce in front of you and I take a live animal and I start cutting the animal up, you're going to react differently in those two situations because you know that even if the plant is alive, there is no mind there that prefers or desires or wants anything. Whereas with the chicken or the fish that's live, or the goat or whatever you're killing, and you know, that's a being that has multiple senses and does have preferences, wants, or desires, and does have a continued interest in life, and does have some sort of mind. It may be different from our mind, but it's got some, you know, that animal has some sort of mind. So I think it's really important to you know, always, education is key here. Now, that may be my prejudice because I'm an educator and I spend my time educating, but I do believe education is key, and education has to itself be nonviolent. Remember something. If you're promoting a philosophy of nonviolence, you got to do it nonviolently. And so I'm trying more and more in my own writing to try to sort of look at it and say, you know, I mean, I try to be very direct in my writing, and Rain Without Thunder, which I wrote in 1996, which was a very, very critical movement of the animal rights. But yes, it was very critical of the movement, but I didn't criticize the integrity of particular individuals. I basically said, these people have these views, I disagree with these views. Now, a lot of people take that as being aggressive or whatever, because a lot of people can't stand any sort of disagreement. And I'm sorry about that. I don't intend them in any way to – I don't intend my writing in any way to question their sincerity, and I try to go out of my way to say that. But I think it's really important that if we are – you know, Gandhi said, you've got to be the change you want the world to see. And you know, you've got – change got to come in you first. So if you want nonviolence to be part of the world, you've got to be nonviolent. And so if you want to be – if you want to promote nonviolence, you've got to do it nonviolently. And that is, you know, so that's why I talk about creative nonviolent education. What do I mean by creative? Well, let me give two excellent examples. My friend Elizabeth Collins in New Zealand, who basically she went on the website and she got slides of you can do this somehow. I don't even know how.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how to do it, but you know, you computer savvy people can do it. You can print out pages of my movies, Theory of Animal Rights and stuff, which I intended to be, you know, I wanted them to be simple presentations of theory without a lot of jargon and stuff. And so what Elizabeth did was she took those things and she downloaded them and she put them in these flip books. And then she goes around and she sets up a table and, you know, she passes out literature. And then if people are interested, she sits there and she goes through the book with them, and she explains the theory, and Elizabeth's very, very bright, and she really understands this stuff, and she explains it very simply and things like that. The other example that comes to mind is my friend Adam Conowitz, who's got his father out there building little things with his dad's help, you know, that little thing you built, that, so what do you call
the
it?
The kiosk.
I mean, I thought that was brilliant. I thought, you know, I see that sort of stuff. I actually have to tell you, I see that sort of stuff. It brings tears to my eyes because I say, this is what I'm talking about. You know, there are some young people out there who really are digging what I'm saying, and they're understanding this. And this is creative, nonviolent, vegan education. You're going around with your kiosk. You're obviously a bright, articulate guy. I've never met you, but, you know, I've, 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 I've interacted with you both, you know, this way and on the internet and stuff. You come across as a very, 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 you know, a knowledgeable, well-spoken, articulate guy. And that's what we need. We need people to teach other people. Because remember something. We live in a screwed up world. We live in a world in which, you know, people think that wars are a way to peace, and people think that, you know, sexism is a way to get gender equality, and people think that, you know, exploiting animals, you know, torturing animals less is a way to get to, you know, not torturing them at all sorts of crazy things. And we've really got to get away from that. But we're screwed up. As a species, for a group of people who pride themselves on being rational, we're about the most irrational creatures on the face of the earth. And we've got to be gentle with people as we educate them. And I think that's really, really very, very important. And you know, I'm not saying one shouldn't be direct, and I'm not saying one shouldn't be clear. You know, I always try to be clear in my debates with people. But I always try to sort of take people when they're coming in at a sort of a newbie level to sort of, you know, to educate them in always, you know, education should always be gentle, but particularly with new people coming in. But where I don't think what we should be doing is to say, well, these are new people, so therefore we don't want to scare them off. So what we ought to do is tell them, let's get, you know, go and eat cage-free eggs, or go and eat, you know, Whole Foods meat. That's another, it's a perfect example. When 10 years ago, maybe more, when I started shopping at Whole Foods, it used to be called Fresh Fields. It's become Whole Foods.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, Fresh Fields. It was originally called Fresh Fields. And they didn't sell any fresh meat or fish there. None. I mean, they sold meat stuff, but it was like frozen stuff and canned. You know, they had meat in cans and stuff. But they didn't have any frozen – any fresh meat or fish. Now Whole Foods, which is what Fresh Fields became, now Whole Foods – has tons and tons of fresh meat and fish. And they've got little signs up. And they've got little signs up that say, you know, these animals were raised humanely. Our partners are, you know, our supplying partners, or whatever the expression is, they're committed to the humane treatment of animals. And then sometimes they have little boards up with pictures of happy, smiling people holding chickens, you know, and stuff. And, you know, on Bob and, you know, Melinda's farm, you know, all the animals are just, you know, they're just lining up at the slaughterhouse because they're just so happy. They're so happy to have been in this situation. Every day, you know, the chickens get up and they say to God, thank you, God, for, you know, and you know, you get these little stories. And it's interesting because I don't know if it was a couple years ago, but they rotate the people around, and the people in grocery get rotated to dairy, the people in dairy get rotated to fresh foods, and then, you know, they get rotated. And I saw this woman who had been in grocery. They had moved her to meat and fish, and so she was standing behind the meat and fish counter, and I walked past and I said, oh my God, you're selling corpses. And she said, yeah, but PETA gave us an award as the best retailer.
Right.
And I thought, this is just rich, isn't it? I mean, I'm walking past a meat counter where there's all these dead bodies and dead fish and stuff with their mouths open and their eyeballs in and stuff and all that sort of stuff. And I'm walking past and I'm saying, this is really horrible. And this woman says to me, and she says it sincerely, she's a good person, she's not a bad, evil person. She says to me, PETA gave us an award, so it's okay. You know, this complies with the animal compassionate standard or whatever it is. And see, this is the sort of thing I think that is really pushing us in the wrong direction. And all I can tell you is this, you know, there's a video on my website. It's probably two or three blog posts. And I think it's called, Is There Anything You Want to Eat That Badly, or something like that. I forgot what I called it. And it's a video taken in a French slaughterhouse. But it doesn't matter, because all slaughterhouse, I don't care whether they're designed by Temple Grandin, whether they're designed by God, or whether they're designed, it doesn't matter. They're all the same. They're all horrible. And but there's a video, I believe it's from a French slaughterhouse. And it's no blood and guts. It's all it is two cows, and they're in a chute and they're waiting to go into the abattoir, and the door raises. It's almost like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre when Leatherface opens the door, and you know, the door raises, And the first cow is prodded in with an electrical stunner. And she goes in, and you just hear this loud boom, you know, which is the cow falling when the cow gets the stun. And then there's this one cow left in the chute. And the whole video is this poor cow frantically trying to get out of the chute, and she's terrified. And there's no blood, there's no guts, there's just this poor little cow, and she knows it's the end, and she knows she's in trouble. Now, is she sitting there thinking, well, you know, I'd wanted to go to the, you know, I'd wanted to go out into the field on next Friday. I won't have a chance to do that, so my future desires are going to be, you know. Is she thinking about her life the way Peter Singer says she should in order to be a moral person? And the answer is no, she's probably not. What she is thinking is something that's equivalent to, I'm in big trouble. This is the end for me. And I look at that face of that terrified cow, and I ask you and all of your listeners, do me that favor. You know, just humor me, for God's sake. Go and watch it. It's like 3 minutes long, you know. I mean, I realize that that's long, you know, for these internet visits. But, you know, watch the video for 3 or 4 minutes, whatever it is. Look at that poor little face and the terror in her eyes and ask yourself, is the ice cream cone worth it? Is the cheese pizza worth it? You know, is
absolutely,
you know, I mean, ask yourself that question. Mm. Now, if you come away saying, yes, it's worth it, well, then, you know, there may be nothing more I can say to you. But you know what? 90% of the people that I talk to this way, they look at it and they're troubled. Now, does that mean they're all going to become vegan? No, it does not, Adam. But you know what? It means some of them are. And it might not happen today, and it might not happen tomorrow. It might not happen until next month. I'll tell you a final story. I was on an airplane. This is probably, probably 2 years. I don't remember. Time. One day blends into the next. But it was a couple years ago, I guess, maybe 2 summers ago. I was on an airplane going to Paris. And I'm sitting next to this woman. And I was thinking about doing another edition of Introduction to Animal Rights, which I decided against doing. But I was thinking of – I decided to do a different book instead. And so I was thinking – but I had Introduction to Animal Rights with me, and I was reading. I was looking, and I was reading, and I was thinking, you know, how would I change this section? How would I change it? So she's sitting next to me. I'm sitting on the aisle, and she's sitting next to me in the middle seat, and she's got a fur coat on. But she doesn't have it on. She has it sort of against you know, like – off of her shoulders, but against her back. And the thing's sort of touching me. And, you know, and you know, people say, well, doesn't that gross you out? And the answer is, I have to be honest with you. I do not think that there's any difference between fur, wool, leather, or silk. I think it's all the same. That's why I don't, you know, it's one of the reasons why I don't get involved in things like anti-fur campaigns, because I think that's totally arbitrary. I mean, there's no difference between fur and leather. So she's sitting there with her leather coat, and it was actually a fox coat. And and so I'm reading this book, and she asked me, she said, she looked at the book, and she said, is that a good book? And I laughed, and I said, yeah, it's a great book, actually. And then we started chatting, and she said, are you an animal rights person? And I said, well, I said, I guess it would depend who you talk to. I said, but yeah, I said, I sort of consider myself an animal rights person. And then, as you know, when you're on a flight like that, if you have a vegan meal or a kosher meal or some other special meal, you generally get your meal before anybody else does. And so, you know, they bring out the special meals first. So, you know, she and I had been talking for about a half an hour, and I was explaining to her, you know, what I thought about the issue. And you know what? I was doing this sort of thing about, you know, well, we all say it's wrong to, you know, inflict unnecessary suffering and blah, blah, blah. And then my dinner comes, and she says, oh, that's a vegetarian meal. And I said, well, actually, I said, yes, it's a vegetarian meal, but it's a strict vegetarian meal. I said, it's not, you know, there's no eggs, there's no milk, there's no cheese, there's no butter, anything like that. Mm-hmm. And she said, oh, and then she asked the air host or whatever they're called these days, and she said, do you have another one of those? And in fact, there was another one, and she had it, and she said, this is not bad. And I said, yeah, you know, it was, you know, it was airline food. It was horrible, actually, but it was, you know, it was like right. as okay. I recall, it was like some sort of pasta in marinara sauce, where the pasta had been cooked for 4 days, to the point where they had done tests on it to ascertain that it had no nutritional value. And so but you know, you're on a French airline. The fact that it doesn't have cream sauce on it, you have to give thanks to God. So she has the vegan meal, And then we continue talking, and she tells me how much she loves her dog. And then I hear, you know, she takes the pictures out. She shows me the pictures of the dog. And then I said to her, I said, this is a fox coat, isn't it? And she said, yeah. And I said, what? I said, foxes are canids. I said, you know, I said, I have foxes in my garden. We have foxes here in the garden. And I said, there's no difference between the dog you love and the fox whose skin fur you're wearing. And she said, oh, I feel really bad because I shouldn't be sitting here with a fur coat. And I said, it wouldn't matter. I said, whether it was leather or wool, I said, I would feel the same about it. And we got into a discussion about that. And then, you know, we got to Paris eventually and said goodbye. And I gave her my card. And I said, if you ever want to have further discussions about this, let me know. And I don't know, maybe, I don't remember how long, maybe 2 months. It was a while. It wasn't immediately. It was a couple months later. She said, I haven't really been able to stop thinking about our discussion on that plane. And she said, she gave her coat to some organization so that they could use it in demonstrations or whatever they use them in. And she said, I'm not 100% vegan, but I'm almost there. She said, basically, she said, I've cut it out of just about everything except my coffee, and I'm working on that, and it's only a matter of time before I'm going to be 100% vegan. And mm-hmm. and I have to also, you know, I'm still thinking about the wool business. I don't know if I can wear clothes without wool, but I understand what you said. And I just wanted to let you know, wanted to thank you for talking with me. So I'm just telling you, you plant seeds, man. You plant seeds.
Yeah.